It is 8:31. We have with us live in the studios once again, Maria Tomczyk with Eat the State. Good morning.
Good morning. Sounds like Jav left and took the music with him.
Well, that would explain why I couldn't find
the CD.
Leo Kottke CD that I was looking for. Seems to disappear now about every 2 months. All right. Well, enough of that. Let's cover what's been going on this last week, starting with the results of the primaries here.
The local primaries, yeah. I'm not going to talk too much about the results in any individual races because there weren't, let's face it, you know, there weren't too many surprises. The top two primary was kind of an interesting exercise. I found it a lot of fun to be able to vote for whoever I wanted to, and that was the attitude that was expressed by a lot of people at the polls, according to election workers. And what we've seen is that the freedom to vote across the parties hasn't changed a whole lot who's going on to the general election. In most races, you had a Democrat and a Republican who are passing through to the general election. In a few cases, however, it's been two Democrats and two Republicans. Mostly, though, it's a Democrat and a Republican. And I think the interesting thing that came out of the primaries is that the turnout was really low. Now, the Secretary of State, Sam Reed, he predicted on Monday that turnout would be about 46%. And as a reason he gave for a higher turnout, he said, you know, this is a presidential election year, so we expect more people to come to the polls in the primaries. I think that was kind of a strange thing to say because actually turnout turned out to be around 30%, and it could be as high as 35% in King County. But I wouldn't hold my breath on that. And I think it really was pretty abysmally low for a presidential election. And I think in spite of the fact that we had a hotly contested governor's race this year. And you could ask why was turnout so low. I think it's largely because the state had moved the primary up to August. And in August, you know, people are either out on vacation or even if they're doing a staycation here in the city, not a lot of people are turning on the radio, not a lot of people are turning on the TV, so they're not getting the ads to remind them to vote, and nobody's really paying attention to political stuff. A lot of people take a news vacation in August at the same time they're taking their work vacation. And I think there was some confusion over the top two primary a little bit. But in general, most people, I think, had the feeling that it didn't matter all that much, that if they didn't bother to vote, that other voters would choose, would weed out the candidates in the race, and that the election that really matters is the general election in November when they'll have a choice between the top two. In a sense, I think it's a reflection of our two-party system, which in fact often seems like a one-party system. People nowadays, I think voters nowadays are kind of lured into this feeling that, I don't even have to look at these other third-party candidates because, you know, they're not going to have the chance to make it through. So what is the point of even voting for them? It's kind of a system-created apathy, I think. And I think that's what the reason why we had such a low turnout in the primary.
And something that instant runoff voting would help solve.
Would certainly solve, yeah. If you had the confidence that that a third-party candidate could make it through to the general election, you would be much, much more likely to vote in the primary. So that was one of the main results of this primary was just the low voter turnout. Another one is the candidates who make a good showing in the primary, the top two, in other words, are the candidates who are going to be out there fundraising and are the ones who are going to be lining up for the donations. And in some races, it's, you know, if the candidates who made the best showing in their district are the ones who are going to be out there hustling up a lot of money, are the ones whose ads you're going to see and are the ones who are likely going to be the ones to win. And the guys who came in second, the men and women who came in second, are the ones who are going to be out there really trying to hustle and really trying to get some attention from the media and from voters. In certain races, like the 46th district, where you have two Democrats, Jerry Pollitt and Scott White, running, it's going to be a tough race for Jerry Pollitt. And it's going to be kind of interesting to see, because you'll see a lot of money spent in these races where you have two Democrats running against each other. Also in the 36th district, where it was almost a dead heat between John Burbank and Reuven Carlisle, you're going to see, I think, tens if not hundreds of thousands of dollars spent on these races where if we didn't have the top two primary, the leading candidate would have been decided already. But you're going to have people raising money and spending money all the way through to November, and these are going to be really expensive races in these two districts. So I think that's another thing we're going to see from the top two primary as well. A lot of money that could have been perhaps used by the Democratic Party to defeat Republicans in other districts are going to be poured into these districts where you've got two Democrats running and where the races are so close.
Or maybe just the money used elsewhere for things like schools.
Yeah, major donors could be giving their monies to food banks right now, or to low-income housing projects, or to other things rather than to political races. That's another issue as well. So other than that, I mean, the primary held few surprises. Governor Gregoire got 49% of the voters in the early returns over Rossi, who had 45%, which is a much better showing than he had the last time he ran, which has got, I think, some Democrats a little bit scared. It should be setting a fire under them regarding how well Rossi may do in the general election. And so other than that, there were very, very few surprises. I-26, the initiative to put on the ballot for nonpartisan to take the King County Executive, the King County Council, and the King County Assessor races and turn them into nonpartisan races. That initiative is passing, so that'll be on the ballot in November, and we'll see which version actually makes it once all of the absentee ballots are counted.
All right. Well, that moves us on then to national and some environmental news.
Yeah, this week a U.S. appeals court for the District of Columbia ruled against the Bush administration, and the Bush administration EPA has been trying to limit states' ability to monitor and enforce industrial emissions under the Clean Air Act. Sometime around 1990, the Congress had passed an amendment to the Clean Air Act that lets states issue permits and limit emissions from industrial polluters. And it gave states the right to set more stringent limits than the federal government had set. And so the Bush administration has been trying to overturn that. In 2006, the EPA issued a rule saying that that was no longer the case, that states would not be able to set limits and issue permits, and could certainly not set limits that were more stringent than the federal government. Well, environmental groups took the EPA to court, and these environmental groups have won now in this U.S. appeals court. So that's a major victory for the environment and for environmental groups. And this comes in the same week that researchers presented the results of a study on air pollution. It seems that researchers may have found the missing link that explains why people who are non-smokers, people who don't smoke, are getting lung cancer in record numbers. What researchers have found is that free radicals that are produced in the combustion process, which they had previously thought existed only briefly and then disappeared in the atmosphere. Free radicals, by the way, can cause damage at the cellular level. Has been known for years that they do this. Researchers had thought in the past that the combustion process produces free radicals, but that the free radicals would dissolve and disappear very quickly in air. What they're finding now is that these free radicals don't disappear. They're actually very persistent in the atmosphere, and they cling to particulate matter. Well, this was a study that you think should have been done a lot earlier. Well, industry isn't necessarily interested in this. It has to be researchers outside of industry to do the study, and it takes a while to get the money and actually do studies when you don't have industry backing. In fact, not only have they found that free radicals attach themselves to particulate matter, but what they found is that the amount of free radicals in moderately polluted air can cause is about equal to the amount of free radicals you'd get if you smoked 300 cigarettes a day. So I think evidence is pointing to this as a major problem. And they're just talking about moderately polluted air. Of course, this isn't an endorsement for cigarette smoking, because cigarette smoke contains a lot of other toxins in addition to free radicals that cause severe lung damage and lung cancer. But here we're also finding that polluted air can cause lung cancer because of these free radicals. And this is something we should also keep in mind in Seattle, because last weekend we violated the Clean Air Act with levels of pollution that we haven't seen since the mid-90s here in this area.
All right. Well, if you were on the fence about smoking before, you live in a major metropolitan area, I guess that could push you over. Moving on.
Well, even if you're not a smoker, polluted air can push you over the edge into lung cancer territory. So we need to do something about it.
Yeah. Moving on, update this week on that salmonella outbreak that happened.
Yeah.
What was that, like months ago now?
Well, yeah, it started months ago and it's been ongoing and continuing up until just fairly recently when the FDA finally came out and said, well, gosh, folks, it wasn't tomatoes after all. We're pretty sure now that it was jalapenos.
After it wiped out pretty much the tomato industry.
Well, it cost something like $200 million worth of damage to the tomato industry. Put a lot of people out of business, I'm sure. But there's been some new news on the salmonella outbreak that sickened some 1,423 people in several states across the United States. Associated Press reporters did an analysis of records from the FDA, and they discovered that shipments of Mexican chili peppers are routinely turned away at the borders for various things, for things like containing filth, for having illegal pesticides in them. In one shipment, there was a poison mixed in with the chili peppers. And about 10% of the shipments that are turned away because they contain salmonella. In fact, since January, 88 separate shipments of chili peppers were turned away at the border for these reasons. The FDA, I should point out, inspects only about 1% of all foreign food that enters the country. And the FDA had only really been paying a lot of attention to dried chili peppers, excuse me, because dried chili peppers are often laid out in the sun in the open air in order to dry them out, and that's when they're often exposed to, you know, wildlife and other types of contamination that can put salmonella, E. coli, other things in amongst the chili peppers. And they weren't really paying much attention to fresh chilies, even though fresh chilies are turned away from the border on a routine basis because they contain filth and other problems. So it was kind of interesting that even with the fact that the FDA is turning away so many shipments at the U.S.-Mexican border, no warning was given to the public that you should be careful, wash your chili peppers watch them closely. If they look like they've been contaminated, don't eat them. You know, no warning was given. There were no stepped-up inspections of shipments of chili peppers. And when the salmonella outbreak first occurred, the government wasted valuable time looking at tomatoes and didn't look at FDA records closely enough to figure out early enough what could have been the real cause. And while they were wasting that valuable time, many, many, many more people got sick from the salmonella bacteria. And I just want to point out, too, that every year some 76 million Americans get sick from foodborne illnesses, and about 5,000 people in the United States die from foodborne illnesses because the FDA doesn't inspect enough, because of industrial farming practices that are not safe and are not regulated by the USDA or the FDA or the Department of Agriculture. It's a shame. It's shocking. So we might ask, how is the FDA responding now that the Associated Press did this little analysis and revealed this problem? Well, the FDA this week issued a ruling on Thursday to allow the grocery industry to irradiate spinach and iceberg lettuce to kill salmonella and E. coli. Instead of doing more inspections, instead of asking for more money, instead of trying to put some decent regulation of the agricultural industry in place, the FDA says, no, we're just going to let grocers go ahead and nuke your food There are major problems with this, aside from radiation exposure, particularly for children. To effectively kill pathogens in produce, they have to irradiate it so much that the produce suffers significant crispness and loss of crispness and nutritional quality. You could be getting your lettuce pre-cooked, in other words, in order to kill 99% of the bacteria. But what is more likely to happen is that groceries are going to mildly irradiate, not kill the bacteria sufficiently, and put the produce up for sale with the sticker saying, "This has been effectively irradiated, you don't have to worry about it." So it's highly likely that this is an extra step that's going to be taken to pollute your food and not actually kill any measurable or any significant amount of the bacteria that causes foodborne illnesses.
You have to wonder if the grocery industry really wants to be doing this in the first place, just from the cost that they have to bear for it.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know. I can't see any benefit even for the grocery industry in doing this. I think the benefit really lies in people who want to revive the nuclear industry and want to bring about more nuclear power and the use of nuclear nuclear industry and the use of so many other places besides just in the uses of medicine, which is pretty much how we use it here in the United States.
All right. Moving on, do you want to move to international?
Yes.
All right. Well, starting with Iraq.
Yeah, the U.S. and Iraq have drawn up a draft security deal. We don't know the details of it, of course, because here in the U.S. it is considered a secret. But apparently the Bush administration will accept a timeline after having said for years, no, we will not accept a timeline for troop withdrawal. Now, the current timeline appears to be June 30th, 2009, for U.S. troops to be pulled out of Iraqi cities, and then December 2011 to get them out of Iraq altogether. Of course, this draft agreement is going to have to be approved by the Iraqi cabinet and then by the Iraqi parliament. And as it turns out, there are already members of the Iraqi cabinet who have problems with the draft agreement and can't agree whether or not it's a good agreement. And the Bush administration won't be submitting this treaty to the U.S. Congress because in their eyes, we don't count. The U.S. public doesn't get a say, and the U.S. Congress doesn't get a say in approving treaties anymore. The members of the Iraqi cabinet, as I said, are already finding flaws. But it would be nice to know what it is that they're objecting to, but we can't know because this treaty is not only not going to be submitted to Congress, it's a secret treaty. And I have to just ask, what other evidence do we need here in the United States as proof that we live under a dictatorship, other than the fact that our government can go ahead and negotiate secret treaties with other governments that we never know the details of and are never allowed to comment on, and that our own representatives are not allowed to vote on?
All right. Moving on. Suicide bombings?
Yeah. Just as the Bush administration is trying to declare victory in Iraq and bring about a close to the war in Iraq, I think it's worth mentioning that Al-Qaeda, even though they may have been mostly kicked out of Iraq, they've taken the war to other shores. And this week it was really apparent. You had major suicide bombings in several nations. This week in Pakistan there were two major suicide bombings, where in the first one there were 30-plus people killed, and in the second one 60-plus people were killed. In Afghanistan, suicide bombings are going on almost daily. And then again in Algeria, there were two more attacks where you had a total of more than 50 people killed and more than 70 people wounded. And in Algeria, where we hadn't been seeing many suicide bombings, Turkey, there was a suicide bombing this week. It's just incredible. Where we're seeing much less of this in Iraq, it's spread all over the Middle East now and probably going to go much further abroad.
All right. And developments this week in Pakistan.
In Pakistan, yeah. President Pervez Musharraf resigned rather than face impeachment. And this was something we could have expected because, of course, for Musharraf to go through the impeachment process would have further destabilized Pakistan. We're going to have to see now, though, if the coalition government run by a combination of Nawaz Sharif, himself a former president, and Zardari, the husband of Benazir Bhutto, who's known as Mr. 10%. Zardari was proposed this week as the replacement for Musharraf. Well, that's not a great sign for Pakistani politics. Zardari is, as I said, Mr. 10%, is known for his corruption. He used to take a cut off of every deal that was done under his wife's former administration. We're going to just have to see if Sharif and Zardari can get along and what this means for Pakistani politics if they're going to dissolve into this internal fighting that could just destroy the government once again. We'll just have to see.
All right, and developments in Bolivia.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. We haven't been hearing much in the Western press about what's going on in Bolivia. We do know that there was a referendum on August 10th, and this was a no-confidence vote on Evo Morales, the nation's first indigenous leader. It was an effort by his opponents, mostly led by a few provincial governors who are against his government and against sharing the resource-rich wealth of their own provinces with the rest of the nation, and particularly against his movement for land reform. They brought about this no-confidence vote against Morales. Morales won the vote by a fantastic two-thirds majority, essentially an overwhelming majority, showing that he has nearly 100% support of the poor people and the indigenous people of Bolivia. And at the same time as this no-confidence vote was occurring, there were votes on the terms of these provincial governors, two of which were voted out of office, and two of those governors have simply refused to leave office, even though the no-confidence vote was brought about by them. They essentially said, well, we want this no-confidence vote, and in the no-confidence vote, they were voted out of office. Now they're refusing to accept the results. Well, the media coverage here has been focusing largely on the general strikes that are going on in those provinces run by the opposition governors. They haven't focused at all on the fact that Morales won the referendum by such a wide margin, and they haven't focused at all on the fact, in fact, it's often mentioned in Western media, that the provincial governors won their races by a wide majority, and that they're trying to oust Morales. It's often shown, these articles are printed from the perspective of the opposition government, clearly reprinting their own propaganda, and not mentioning at all that two of those governors were voted out of office but have refused to leave and are essentially trying to undermine the democratic process in Bolivia. That's something that I think should be pointed out and hammered on, because the Western press is really falling down on the job.
All right. So that pretty much wraps up international, and we move on to this week's economic news.
Yeah. Mike was just talking to me before we went on the air. I asked him, what economic news has kind of puzzled you this in the last week or two? And he kind of scratched his head, and he said, well, these bank things with Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and everything falling apart. I just want to know, when's it really going to fall apart? And I have to say, Mike, that's pretty much the question that other economists are asking right now. Things appear to be falling apart. When are they really going to fall apart? You know, with the market going up and down and stock prices for Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and Lehman Brothers and Bear Stearns and all these other companies going up and down and up and down and up and down, you're wondering, when are things really going to fall apart? The answer to that is nobody really knows. But there are people out there making predictions, and one of those people this week was an ex-economist at the IMF, a man by the name of Kenneth Rogoff. And on Tuesday, he said that he expected a large U.S. bank collapse to happen sometime this year, sometime before the end of this year. And he was mainly thinking in terms of an investment bank, but, you know, I think he was also looking at Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and saying that could happen as well. Of course, in the case of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, they wouldn't be allowed to collapse. They're so big, and that if they collapsed, they would take down much of the rest of the market with them. So taxpayers would have to step in and do a major bailout of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. That's what's been an issue.
Didn't they just do that?
So
they do it again.
But that was sort of a partial bailout. That was saying we're going to extend a line of credit to you in case you need it. Well, it wasn't coming in and saying, well, okay, here we are. We're going to buy you out, et cetera. That's the major bailout that we're probably looking at down the line. And most people are probably scratching their heads saying, why? Why Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, and why now? Well, the truth is, as I've said before, we've got a wave of mortgages that are imploding. The first wave is actually going to come in three waves. The first wave we've crested is the subprime mortgage market. The second wave that's coming along are these Alt-A or Alternative A mortgages that were more mortgages given to people who didn't have to prove their sources of income or whether they had any assets, primarily given to people who were real estate developers or getting in on the real estate development kick, people buying second and third houses to fix up and flip. Those are people who got Alt-A mortgages. That's the second wave that's starting to hit right now. And there's a third wave waiting in the wings of people with adjustable rate mortgages that's starting to appear on the horizon. People who who had option mortgages as well, who took out these mortgages with low teaser rates that are going to start resetting. And there's a wave of those. It comes in sort of annual or semi-annual waves. The first wave of that is hitting now as well. But that's going to go for the next 2 or 3 years because those mortgages were written up through the middle of last year. It takes about 2 or 3 years for those rates to reset. So that's a wave that's going to hit through 2010, 2011. So that's why Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac are in trouble, because as it turns out, they bought up a lot of those mortgages, and they still hold a lot of those on their books. And so many people have said that about 40% to 50% of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac's holdings are made up of these risky mortgages. So that's why they're in trouble, and that's why we're looking at a bailout of them down the road. So we've only got about a minute left. Maybe we should do announcements.
Yeah, events.
Yeah, some events this week. One is a GI Coffee House. During the Vietnam War, there were GI Coffee Houses all over the U.S. The GI Coffee House movement was instrumental in helping to organize against the Vietnam War and helping troops returning from Vietnam and those who were looking at deployment deal with their situation. There's a new GI Coffee House movement starting up with one here in this area. They're going to be having a fundraiser on Monday, August 25th, from 7 to 9 p.m. at the Richard Hugo House at 1634 11th Avenue, 7 to 9 p.m. on Monday. I urge people to go and check it out. The special guest speaker is Todd Ensign. He's director of Citizen Soldier. Go find out what's going on in the GI anti-war movement. It is fascinating stuff. And then another event this week, there's a Nicholsville Die-In and Rally. Homeless activists and other people who are against the city's homeless sweeps in city parks are setting up what they call Nicholsville, a little encampment for homeless people. They're going to do a die-in and rally Friday, August 29th at Westlake Park from 4:30 to 5:30 p.m. I urge people to go and check that out as well.
Take off on Hooverville.
Yes.
All right. Talking as we do every week with folks from Eat the State, this week with just Maria Tomchik. And tell people where they can find Eat the State.
You can find Eat the State in bookstores, coffee shops, cafes, public libraries, places around town where you find free publications. And we're also up on the web at www.eatthestate.org.